VOA News, I'm Lori London. Senator John McCain's casket has arrived in Maryland ahead of ceremonies Friday at the U.S. Capitol. McCain was flown to Joint Base Andrews outside Washington after a church service Thursday in Phoenix. Former Vice President Joe Biden, dabbing his eyes as he spoke at the service, said he believes McCain's death has hit people so hard because they knew he believed so deeply and so forcefully in the soul of America.
It wasn't about politics with John. He could disagree on substance, but it was the underlying values that animated everything John did, everything he was.
Six-term Republican senator from Arizona will lie in state under the U.S. Capitol Rotunda on Friday for a ceremony and public visitation. On Saturday, McCain's procession pauses by the Vietnam Memorial and heads for Washington National Cathedral for a formal funeral service. McCain died last Saturday of brain cancer at the age of 81. President Donald Trump has told Congress he's canceling a pay raise that most civilian federal employees were due to receive in January, citing budgetary constraints. Trump informed House and Senate leaders in a letter sent Thursday that says federal agency budgets cannot sustain such increases. The president also told a campaign-style rally in Indiana on Thursday that his administration is, quote, standing up for free speech rights, warning that large social media companies could not be allowed to control what we can and cannot see. He blamed Google, Facebook, Twitter, and other social media giants and said that political censorship blacklisting and called it a rigged search result. This is VOA. Organizers of Aretha Franklin's funeral insist it will be a service, not a show. The Queen of Soul's final send-off Friday in Detroit will boast a lineup of speakers and singers that would rival any of the hottest venues, past or present. And it follows 2 days of a public viewing that drew thousands paying their respects, the AP's Ed Donahoe reports.
In Arizona, he was our hero. I think you can see from this outpouring of support and love for John McCain that he was America's hero.
The line for public viewing stretched more than a half mile. A white 1940s Cadillac hearse brought the casket of the Queen of Soul into the church. Joyce Stroud traveled from Florida to Detroit.
It was absolutely beautiful. She was in a bronze casket this time. And she looked at peace.
Friend Michael Eric Dyson was asked, what would Aretha Franklin think about all this attention?
It would be truly humbling to her, although let's not forget she was a diva. So the diva will be respected and the diva will be recognized.
Among those who will be at Aretha Franklin's funeral, Stevie Wonder, Jennifer Hudson, and former President Bill Clinton. I'm Ed Donahue.
The United Nations is issuing a stark warning about a potential catastrophic loss of life if Syrian forces with Russian support mount a full-scale military assault to retake Idlib province, the last major rebel-held enclave in Syria. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Nearly 3 million people are crammed into this small rebel-held enclave. About half that population includes displaced people who have fled from previous areas of conflict, many of them women and children. U.S. Special Envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, says all these lives are at stake because there is no other Idlib. He says there is no other place where people can go. De Mistura is calling for patience before rushing into military action. He says time is needed to devise ways to save the civilian population. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The former NSA contractor sent to prison for leaking classified information is speaking out about what she did. AP correspondent Rita Foley reports.
Reality Winner is doing more than 5 years in prison for leaking a classified report on Russian hacking. Does she regret what she did?
Yes, deeply.
She spoke by telephone from the Lincoln County Jail in Georgia, telling CBS this morning that she appreciates a tweet from President Trump, who said that what she did was, quote, small potatoes compared to what Hillary Clinton did.
Even our commander-in-chief, President Trump, has kind of come out and said, wait a minute, this is really unfair. There's this double standard here, and for that I can't thank him enough.
This is VOA. I'm Lori London.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Boateng in Washington. Today is Friday, August 31st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ugandan police Thursday rearrested two badly wounded members of parliament at the airport.
He's not in good health, and he had been referred for further medical examination and management in the USA. And when he reached the national airport, he was rearrested brutally by the police.
Menda Seguna is state lawyer for Ugandan parliamentarian Bobby Wine. We'll look at youth politics in the DRC as that country prepares for its December presidential election. High transport fares in Liberia are wreaking havoc on commercial transport operators. And Nigeria's Senate president announces his candidacy for the 2019 presidential election.
He identified some of the problems of the country, particularly the problems of insecurity, the problem of very bad economy. He noted that the country cannot afford to continue with the same type of leadership.
Yusuf Olaniyonu is the spokesman for Nigerian Senate President Bukola Saraki. Africans are living longer and healthier lives these days, and there is a gathering in Zimbabwe next month to share stories about albinos and their acceptance. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ugandan police on Thursday rearrested two badly wounded members of parliament at Entebbe Airport, preventing them from leaving the country for medical treatment in India and the United States, respectively. A police source said MPs Francis Zaki and Robert Chigulayin, also known as Bobby Wine, were arrested because they had no clearance to travel abroad. According to their lawyers, the two had been badly beaten and tortured 2 weeks ago while campaigning in a by-election in Arua, Uganda. They were charged with treason for illegal possession of arms and ammunition and destruction of property. Menda Segona, lawyer for parliamentarian Bobby Wine, says his client was traveling to the United States for advanced medical treatment and that there is no law or court order that prevents him from doing so.
He's not in good health, and he had been referred for further medical examination and management in the USA. And when he reached the national airport, he was rearrested brutally by the police, bumped into a waiting police ambulance, and driven to a government hospital that is in pieces and shambles. Allegedly, the government wants to examine him and ascertain whether he's actually sick or not, which is strange because the question of his sickness is not before any court of law. No court order has been produced to require him undergo a medical examination by government, and he has not given his consent to be treated in a government facility because he believes that his tormentors cannot provide medical care to him, and it's done against his will.
We are hearing that another member of parliament was also arrested at the Entebbe airport.
That's correct. Francis Zaki was tortured in the hands of the military. He was badly beaten. In particular, the presidential guards, the SFC, or Special Forces Command, and he was admitted in hospital. They surrounded the hospital, and we protested. So they left, and we thought that finally civility had reigned. So today, as he attempted to leave the country for India, where he had been referred for treatment, he was arrested and forcefully taken to a government facility, which is sick by itself, but the government insists he must be treated from there. He must be examined against his will because they want to contradict that he's not sick. Remember, the Honorable Bob Wine was also treated in a military facility against his will. I'm sure the government is trying to hide something.
As you know, the Honorable Bobby Wine and also the Honorable Zaki, they have been charged with crimes by the police. I'm looking at an article from the Monitor newspaper quoting an unnamed police source saying that the Honorable Zaki or Bobby Wine did not get clearance from the police to travel. Were you told anything?
First of all, Honorable Bobby Wine was charged in court. He was granted bail. There are conditions which were given to him, and that he shouldn't travel out of the country is not one of the conditions given by court. There is no law that requires clearance from the police before anybody travels or leaves the country. For the Honorable Francis Zaki, They never mentioned of any charges until this evening when they brutally arrested him from the airport. Indeed, he spent the whole day in the airport. They were not allowing him anywhere outside the airport. And they were looking for offenses, which they couldn't find, until they finally said he will be charged with treason after getting better.
There is another report that a court has ordered the military intelligence to produce Bobi Wine's bodyguard. Are you aware of that?
Yes, I am aware. We went to court, obtained a court order requiring intelligence to produce him, and they haven't. I don't even think they will respect that court order. They have disrespected court orders before because, according to them, they know what is best for the country, and nobody else knows.
Menda Sigona is the lawyer for Ugandan parliamentarian and popular musician Bobi Wine. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Nearly 50% of the Democratic Republic of Congo's population of 70 million people is below the age of 18. Yet millions say they feel abandoned by successive governments. Young Congolese are stepping in, raising their voices to demand attention from their government as the nation prepares for the December polls. In this report, we meet youth leaders from political parties as well as nonpartisan youth activists to find out what youth in the DRC's capital are asking their government for and how far they are willing to go in their demands. And here's Chika Odua reports from the DRC capital, Kinshasa.
The DRC's youth, angered by poor security and a stifled democracy, have been at the forefront of calls for President Joseph Kabila to step down. At a June protest, they accused Kabila of failing to tackle the rampant sexual violence against women in the rest of Eastern region. Some of the activists were arrested and beaten, including 20-year-old university student Benta Loma and her older sister. She says, "They brutalized us harshly. All we want is the liberty of those that have been assaulted. They were so harsh to us, and we were just having a peaceful protest." But in August, Kabila eased concerns he might try to extend his 17-year rule when he announced he will not run in December elections. Serge Loyabeya is tasked with trying to attract young people to the party of Kabila.
La jeunesse constitue la couche sociale la plus active dans la société.
He says they have over 55% of the population, and in the heart of the party, also, there are a lot of youth. For the vision of the party, for the doctrine and ideology to be realized, the youth are needed. But the DRC's young activists say the government lacks transparency and has mismanaged the country's vast mineral wealth. Ornea Mujinga says young people are skeptical of those in power. She says, "The problem in Congo is that we are not free. We are not free at all. We're in the hands of a few people who want to manipulate us, who want to take us according to their ambitions." The DRC's largest opposition party, the Union for Democracy and Social Progress, says young people are also at the heart of its agenda, and it is promising change. The UDSP's Youth League leader, Clement Baruti, says they were pleased when Kabila announced he would step down. He says, "We want a government that is ruled by law and civil rule, because without such, the vision for progress will not work." Political analyst Felician Kabamba says the DRC's youth have long been neglected. He says, "The plight of youth is catastrophic. I do believe that great opportunities can come from the upcoming elections if some candidates will identify and stress education and then alleviate the precarious living conditions of our youth." But at the ruling party's campaign office, some are already celebrating. Kabila's party has fronted former Interior Minister Emmanuel Ramazani Shadari as its presidential candidate. Many believe if Shadari is elected in December, it will still be Kabila who is pulling the strings. Chika Odua for VOA News, Kinshasa.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, August 31st. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. The president of Nigeria's Senate, Bukola Saraki on Thursday announced his candidacy for the 2019 presidential election on the ticket of the main opposition People's Democratic Party, the PDP. Senator Saraki is one of more than 47 legislators who defected in droves this year from the ruling All Progressives Congress Party. He and other potential aspirants, like former Vice President Atiku Abubakar, are seeking the nomination of the PDP. Spokesman Yusuf Olaniyonu says Senator Saraki has criticized the government of President Buhari for its handling of the economy, the unemployment, and rising insecurity.
During a speech he gave to some youths across the country gathered in Abuja, he identified some of the problems of the country, particularly the problems of insecurity, the problem of very bad economy, youth unemployment, and so many other problems plaguing the country. He noted that the country cannot afford to continue with the same type of leadership that has refused to work, that we need to think out of the box and find a new solution to the problem, to provide a bold leadership for the country, a leadership that will carry along all sectors of the society. He actually mentioned what he would do about youth employment, increasing the capacity of the youth, and actually preparing them as the soldiers for reviving the economy.
If you talk to officials in the current government of President Buhari about the economy, they gave you a very beautiful picture of how they say the economy is doing. They tout, of course, their fight against corruption. They tout, of course, the fight to repatriate stolen Nigerian government money. They speak highly about how the economy is doing. But yet, Mr. Saraki is saying that he's running because he wants to improve the economy.
It depends on who you want to believe. But the question Nigerians will have to ask themselves is that, are their lives better in the last 3 years? If you look at all the statistics, you will see that the majority of Nigerians will say that their lives have gotten worse. So where is that prosperity that we are talking about? In fact, you could see that the poverty situation is linked to the widespread violence that you have across the country. When people are poor, they become aggressive.
The senator, he's one of the people who defected from the ruling APC. He's going to the PDP, where there are already other potential candidates. Is he willing to work with anybody in case he does not get the nomination?
You see, the People's Democratic Party has presented itself that this is like a born-again party. It's a reformed and revived party, a party that now promises internal democracy, inclusiveness, and giving everybody a level playing field. He will put in his best. If he gets the ticket, he expects that others will support him. If he does not get the ticket, he will definitely support others.
The senator talked about the rising insecurity in the country. As you know, yes, Boko Haram continues to be the pin in the side of the Nigerian government or the Nigerian people. What would the senator do in case he's elected? How would he deal with Boko Haram?
You see, the first thing is to take a holistic review of the security architecture. And in that holistic review, you have to determine, number one, are the right persons in charge of the various agencies, the right qualified, determined, ready to work, ready to deliver? Are they given targets to meet? Are they meeting those targets? Are they being well supervised? You know, one of the differences that we can make is provision of leadership, getting people to be answerable, taking responsibility for the position they are holding. These are some of the areas where more vigorous leadership can make the difference.
Yusuf Olaniyonu is the spokesman for Nigerian Senate President Bukola Saraki. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. In Liberia, the high cost of fuel and subsequent transportation fares have led to conflicts between the government and commercial transport operators. In July this year, the government announced regulations of transport fares. But as Moses Garzia would report from the capital, Monrovia, it appears commercial transport operators are not taking the new regulations seriously.
This is Broad Street, Liberia's most popular street. This is the center of attraction for activities in the capital, Monrovia. Taxi drivers and their car loaders, as they are referred to in Liberia, are trying to lure commuters to their cabs expected for different destinations in the capital and surroundings. It is not just about boarding these cabs. The fares associated with them are huge, based on destinations that probably most Liberians cannot afford. For instance, it will cost a commuter US$0.80 for a 35-minute distance, unless the government has meanwhile instituted a controversial reduction on transportation fares, which was announced July 27. Following the pronouncement, it appears that local transport operators have some serious problem with the fares and appear unwilling to abide by it anytime soon.
For now, we are not charging as per the government regulation, because if you do that, you notice that from Broad Street to EAW Junction, to go and come round trip, you'll be burning like 1 gallon. And if you take your 1 gallon money from there, you will be left with $60.
Before then, we were buying a fuel for $4.20, but now fuel has gone up to $560. And then the government is mandating us to carry passenger for $40, which will not benefit us, because the car not for you, we're putting for somebody. You buy fuel for $560 and then carry someone for $40. You may run the whole day, you may not even get the report money, nor even the gas money.
Even commuters feel the pinch of the drivers, who they say cannot do otherwise in the absence of proper regulations on the cost of gasoline and diesel by the government.
Well, you cannot blame the drivers, because the drivers are still buying the petroleum high price. And I think you hold the government accountable or responsible, because they have previously stated that they were going to reduce the petroleum prices. As we speak, the prices on the market are still the same.
But the government says it has done due diligence to all sectors, and it does not have absolute control over petroleum prices. According to the Assistant Director of Press at the Liberia Ministry of Transport, Lemuel Clemmy, the government has been successful in reducing petroleum prices at an appreciable level.
There's an increase in the price of petroleum products on the international market, which obviously affects Liberia. We are no exception. So we have been observing the price on the international market. We as a government, we have decided that we observe it and we should have done over the period, but transportation fares continue to be arbitrarily hacked by commercial drivers. It is in this vein that we decided to come in with the collaboration of the Ministry of Commerce and even the very transport unions through their leadership for us to go on the drawing table to do adjustment in the transportation fares.
Meanwhile, stand penalties awaits violators of the government-regulated transport fares, according to Clemmy. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Moses Gazio reporting from Monrovia, Liberia.
The World Health Organization says Africans are living longer and healthier lives, but the WHO warns that millions on the continent still face the challenge of chronic diseases. Sophia Christensen reports from Dakar.
Meeting in Dakar this week with officials from 47 African countries, the WHO said Africans are living longer lives in good health. Healthy life expectancy on the continent rose from 44.4 years at the turn of the century to 53.8 years in 2015. Overall life expectancy climbed from 50.8 years to 61.2. Matidiso Moeti is the WHO's regional director for Africa.
What's produced this result is a huge increase in access to treatment for HIV/AIDS and in the better in prevention and better management of malaria.
But the WHO says the type of disease that most commonly affects Africans is also changing. While the number of deaths from diarrheal disease, respiratory infections, and HIV is falling, chronic conditions, such as cancer and heart disease, are claiming more lives. Death rates from non-communicable diseases have remained steady since 2000, while the other top 10 causes of mortality in Africa have fallen by 40%. The WHO says health services in Africa have been slow to adapt to the new health challenges. Humphrey Karamagi is a Sustainable Development Goal Coordinator for the WHO. He says the health needs of African youth are too often overlooked.
The kind of health challenges that adolescents face are quite different from what we have been used to responding to. Drug use, adolescent obesity, and so on.
Many African health officials and experts point to a lack of funding. But Stanley Okolo, head of the West African Health Organization, says that is overly simplistic.
There is health, which is an issue in terms of investment, health funding, but there is also an issue in terms of health systems and how you can deliver better value for the money you have. And both have to be tackled simultaneously.
African nations spend an average 40% of their health budgets on medical products, while barely a fifth goes to medical staff and infrastructure. Health officials from Kenya, Nigeria, and Cabo Verde
say they are responding to the rise in non-communicable diseases by focusing on prevention and promoting healthy lifestyles. Sophia Christensen for VOA News, Dakar.
Our time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin in the US, where South Africa's Kevin Anderson will take on rising Canadian star Denis Shapovalov in his third round US Open fixture later this evening. Kevin Anderson has sailed into the third round of the US Open after comfortably dispatching Frenchman Jeremy Chardy. The fifth-seeded Anderson, runner-up to world number one Rafael Nadal in last year's final, beat Chardy 6-2, 6-4, 6-4 in 1 hour and 57 minutes.
I mean, yeah, just, you know, I was thinking of, like, you know, Wimbledon obviously is, you know, playing long matches, and it's just so different, the physicality and these kind of conditions when you, where you're just losing so much fluid. Drunk so much right now, and yeah, it was tough. I mean, especially, you know, early on in that third, you know.
And back here in Africa, top athletics official David Okiyo of Kenya has been handed a life ban by the sports world ruling body, the IWAF. David Okiyo, a former Secretary General and Vice President of Athletics Kenya, as well as a member of the IWAF Council, was found guilty of diverting funds from a contract between Athletics Kenya and sports giant Nike to his own personal benefit. Okiyo had been provisionally suspended by the IWAF in November 2015, along with two other Kenyan officials, former Athletics Kenya President Isaiah Kiplagat, who died in August 2016, and Athletics Kenya Treasurer Joseph Kinyua. In volleyball news, Cameroon and Nigeria have both qualified for the semifinals of the ongoing Under-20 African Cup of Nations Championship, with host Kenya finishing in third place just after one win. Kenya was kicked out of the championship after losing 3-1 to Cameroon in their final Pool A match at the Kasarani Indoor Arena on Thursday. Paul Otio is the head coach of Kenya Volleyball Under-20 women's team.
We need to get ready for everything. I know the Kenyan people are very anxious, and they get irritated when their team lost at home.
For his part, Cameroon head coach Yvan Claude is excited that his team made it through after defeating hard-fighting Kenya.
Kenya have a good team, and when we see Kenya play, you remark that this team no train longer together. Yes.
And now to golf. The 14th edition of the All-Africa Challenge Trophy got underway on Wednesday in Ghana. The all-female competition have 18 African countries vying for the coveted trophy. Host Ghana will battle against teams from Mali, Angola, Cameroon, Burkina Faso, Cote d'Ivoire, Egypt, and Gabon. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Ugandan police on Thursday rearrested two badly wounded members of parliament at Entebbe Airport, preventing them from leaving the country for medical treatment in India and the United States, respectively. That's it for this Friday, August 31st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Dave Magnus, I'm James Butter wishing you a very good weekend.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, VOA presents a town hall special introducing members of the Mandela Washington Fellows for Young African Leaders Initiative. The 2018 Yali Fellows pledge to continue Nelson Mandela's legacy, highlighting the Yali Fellows on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Childhood cancers are highly curable, with long-term survival rates as much as 80%. But for pediatric cancer patients living in refugee camps, access to care is a daunting prospect. On Press Conference USA, we'll speak with two doctors from St. Jude Children's Research Hospital about their global efforts to continue care for displaced pediatric cancer patients. Listen to us Saturday and Sunday on Press Conference USA, only on The Voice of America.